Welcome to Local Energy Rules, a podcast about people putting together great community renewable energy projects and examining how energy policies help or hurt the development of clean local power. My name is Wade Underwood. This week, John Farrell and I talk with Paul Spencer, president and founder of the Clean Energy Collective in Carbondale, Colorado. The collective is pioneering the process of delivering clean power generation through medium-scale facilities collectively owned by participating utility customers. Here's John and Paul now.
Welcome to the show, Paul.
Thanks. Well, good to have you.
Now, one of the things I think is really exciting for me about having you on the program is that the Clean Energy Collective is in some ways the holy grail of community solar projects, which is it's a model that seems to be replicable. You've not only done multiple projects in Colorado, but also in Minnesota. Can you tell us a little bit about how you've made that happen?
So I mean, I think a lot of that came from just the original strategy for putting together this model. And that was from the outset, we really strived to find something that was going to be widely replicable. So we did a lot of investment into the research for the, from the securities perspective, from a tax perspective as far as the ITC credit, how to optimize that, as well as just the supporting software to provide on-bill credits with utilities. So we kind of looked at what would it take for utilities as well as individuals to adopt this on a wide scale early on, and then drove towards that goal to put the necessary pieces in place to make that a reality.
Now tell me a little bit about, you can see on your website, you talk about that software solution that you offer to utilities. Tell me how that makes it easier for them to work with you on community solar projects.
Yeah, so essentially what it does, it's a software called Remote Meter, which basically allows us to meter these remote solar arrays. So take a couple thousand panel array that's community sited, and then we're able to parse that down to each individual's panels that they own within that community solar array. So that part isn't really rocket science. Where it gets to be a little bit more difficult and more beneficial to the utility is we then integrate with the utility's billing system and apply that respective credit that the customer should receive for the power produced from their panels directly on the customer's bill. So the reason that's a necessity in our mind is that it relieves any barriers from the utility as far as additional burden that they have on their staff to be able to implement these types of systems.
Now, you also talked about already the way in which you sort of did a lot of groundwork before you got started doing projects, figuring out how you would have a model that would work to put all the pieces together. Could you talk a little bit about the challenges with the securities law and how you've managed to solve that problem? It's something we've talked about on our program before.
You know, many of the problems that lie with securities laws specific to community solar have to do with that you're building a singular solar array with, you know, a couple thousand panels, and you're allowing hundreds of individuals to then own a solar array. And so is there a split of ownership of a single entity? There's basically four main securities laws or securities, you know, criteria that you have to compare against. And we do probably two dozen different things throughout our model and how we do things to deal with, to adequately address those different securities laws. The simplest one, so I can't really go into all the detail on those because obviously we've invested considerable time and effort doing so. But the simple side is, you know, for instance, in the case where you have multiple owners of a single item or a single product, what we've done is basically broken that up. So no two individuals within our arrays own a single panel, meaning or have joint ownership in a single panel. I guess is more appropriately to say it. So what I mean by that is that there's a one-to-one relationship between customers or owners and panels. No panel is owned by two customers. And we do that through a UCC filing, which is basically kind of a title recording with the state in which the array lies. It really shows that this individual has that specific ownership of the specific panel as opposed to some type of joint ownership. And that's done with a serial number, as well as a panel layout app that shows our customers exactly what panels they own within the physical array.
That's very interesting. And then, I'm just going to ask this question because I recently wrote a story about Solar Mosaic, which is doing kind of a different take on community solar, more of an investment perspective. And as I recall, they were also struggling with the securities laws issue and had been able to open up investment in only two states, California and New York, more broadly, and then they were kind of limited in other states. Is your model limited by any particular state's law, or have you kind of figured out something that works nationwide?
Yeah, so we've built our model to federal law, and so far we've been able, in the states that we have done a deeper dive, it's been able to comply within the state laws as well. So that's been, I think, unique and certainly something that is one of the large obstacles in doing so. In the Mosaic model, which I think is very clever as well and is another way to get solar adoption up there, they're specifically doing and allowed security through the SEC on a much smaller scale and essentially doing that in the form of getting a loan from those individuals that then Mosaic can use towards building facilities or anything else it wants to do with that money that it's borrowed from those individuals. So it's a bit different in that there isn't specific ownership, but it does then succeed. Well, it really doesn't succeed. It succeeds in being allowable security on a small level that the SEC has decided is doable for smaller facilities.
Tell me a little bit about how your model makes it easier to handle all of the various incentives that are out there for building solar. That's one of the challenges facing a lot of sort of the nonprofit models for community solar, but it seems like that's something that you guys have figured out pretty well.
Yeah, so essentially where the nonprofits have difficulty is specifically with the tax credit. Nonprofits don't pay taxes, and therefore they aren't applicable to receive tax credits in the form of the ITC or otherwise. There's actually a variety of different incentives that we routinely deal with. The first is certainly the ITC, which is, of course, 30% of the cost, and that's obviously the largest one. There's then also different incentives that might be rebates from the local utility on a per-watt basis, PDI rebates that are done on a production basis, on a per-kilowatt-hour basis, also the sale or culmination of renewable energy certificates within these arrays. And so here again, we kind of started with a pretty good vision in mind when we started the company, and our desire was to optimize all of those incentives to the benefit of the customer. And we felt if we can drive the optimal solution that takes advantage of all the benefits on the table, then we can make it as appealing as possible to customers, and obviously, hopefully, that results in wide-scale adoption of solar and renewables. And so we then take, for example, on those three instances, we take the ITC at a corporate level and then pass that benefit through on a one-to-one basis to the consumer. Obviously, you have to do some thinking as far as how to structure these assets or be able to take the corporate structure. On the PDI or the rebate side, we do those directly with the utility, and we, again, normally take those in on a per-customer basis, just as though the customer had received that rebate, and then again deduct it from their net price. So the customer never comes out of pocket, then receives a rebate check down the line or an ITC down the line. They get all that deducted up front, which, of course, minimizes their barrier to entry because it's lowering the price of the system from day one.
Paul, can you tell us how customers sign up and then talk a little bit about their return for signing up with the Clean Energy Collective?
Yeah, so essentially the sign-up process takes kind of one of two measures. The first is they just get in contact with us, with our sales folks, whether that be via phone or if it be at an event. We do community events, farmers markets, things of that nature. The second is they can actually go online and completely price the system, see a proposal, and even purchase a system through online tools, which are the only solar company I know of actually in the world where you can actually fully purchase a solar system online any kind of way you want, and we never have to come out to your house. We never have to check your roof. We never have to keep shading. In fact, you didn't have to have a home. On the payback side, it varies wide because prices of power, number of sunlight hours, any rebates that are in play, any RECs that are in play, all those types of incentives. But typically what we see on the low end is somewhere around a 5% year one simple return on investment, which comes to about a 15 or 16 year payback period. And on the that would be on the low end. On the high end, so far we've seen almost double that, so almost 10% return on investment per year on year one, and then paying off in less than 10 years, usually around 8 years or something of that nature. And it just depends on where you are in the country as far as those incentives and so forth that make up that payback period. And essentially what that means is if I put $1,000 into panels, it's going to produce about $100 worth of power every year, would be a 10% simple return. And then I'm going to make my $1,000 back over that 8-year period. And that's because of inflation and so forth that impact that price over time.
Now, one thing I remember being interesting when I was initially looking into your model is that a lot of the other community solar projects out there are kind of a leasing arrangement where the customer will sign up and maybe have a 15-year lease of one of the panels or a set of panels within that common array. But in your model, it's about ownership and, as I recall, fairly long-term as well.
Yeah, so a lot of that came from our initial, you know, strategy or direction as well. So my initial desire was to, you know, tear down as many barriers to entry as possible for people to adopt more clean energy. And so I essentially, before launching the Clean Energy Collective, I put together a list of what I thought the barriers to entry were. And I, for example, from a background perspective, I'm an electrical engineer by trade or by schooling, and I lived off the grid for the last 10 years. So I understand what it takes to, you know, to live off the grid and what kind of investment that took, especially, you know, 10 years ago, it was an enormous investment. Say that today it's still a sizable investment, but much, much smaller. And so all of that drove me towards that. I thought the number one barrier to entry was price. That solar was never a really good financial investment. And until, and actually since the advent of the Clean Energy Collective, although we have nothing to do with this, solar has come down dramatically in the last couple of years. It's still not a fantastic investment in some areas, but it's approaching it very quickly, which is certainly exciting. So that being the number one barrier, the number two barrier that I felt was accessibility, was that, you know, statistically, in my research, 85% of Americans can't have solar no matter how much money they have because they're site constrained, or they rent, or they have mature trees in their front yard, or their roof is, you know, facing the wrong direction, et cetera. So all of that together really drove me towards, we need to find the maximum financial benefit to the consumer. And that's why we work really hard to optimize all those incentives that we just discussed. But the bigger issue is, how much return do they get over the life of the system? And so you have two ways to influence that. The first is to influence the period in which they own it or which they benefit from it. And the second is to draw down the cost of the system as low as possible. So starting with the latter one, because that's the easier one, we said, well, that's easy. We'll build in bulk, and so we'll get bulk pricing, and we'll pass that through to the consumer. So we're pulling down the price as low as we can. But then the other aspect was, we could have gone to a 15-year lease or 20-year lease and avoided a lot of the securities law concerns. If you do that correctly, it's fairly easy to skirt those laws. However, what it means is that the consumer only has 15 years of benefit, and they don't own the underlying asset, which is actually quite valuable in the 15th year, and the 16th year, and the 20th year, and the 25th year, and so forth. And so, again, kind of going towards maximizing that consumer value, as well as wanting to put out a product that I myself would purchase, we passed on the lease model. It was actually the first model we looked at 3.5 years ago with our lawyers was, hey, a lease would be the easiest way to do this. And we ran the numbers, and we said, okay, that's pretty minimal return over time. I mean, you know, you just break even, you don't own anything anymore, and it goes away. And so we then ran, fortunately, comparison to ownership, and it's night and day. I mean, it's literally over a life of a system. An ownership model will produce nearly 3 to 4 times as much asset value as a lease. So that's 3 to 4 times as much payback to the consumer. And so that really set us in the side of, you know, we understand it's going to be hard, but we got to figure out how to have people own this, because that's what's going to make the most financial sense.
So can you tell us about what policies make your job easier? For instance, does the Solar Gardens law in Colorado help you out?
Yes. So in many respects, things like Solar Gardens in Colorado, or group net metering laws or virtual net metering laws, things of that nature do make it easier to get the projects, at least going with the utility. But we only have one utility that we've been able to leverage those types of programs with, and that is the Solar Gardens program in Colorado, only applies to Xcel Energy. So little known, we had actually partnered with and installed, well, I want to say, 5 different utilities before we broke ground on our first Xcel program. In fact, now that I think about it, 7 different utilities before we broke ground on Xcel program. So it's not a necessity. It certainly makes it easier, but it makes it harder in some instances as well, because those laws have, and that kind of legislation, has different types of requirements that are in some instances more onerous than when we just walk in and partner with a utility under a power purchase agreement or something of that nature, which is what we've been doing for many years.
Paul, can you tell us a little bit about, you know, what Clean Energy Collective has in the pipeline, maybe other states that you're expanding into, and also where people can go to learn more about your program?
Sure. No, so we're really excited. I mean, we continue to just be overwhelmed with the response to our model and the ability to allow community members to actually own these assets and have them be the number one benefactor from the assets. That's one thing I didn't mention in the lease model. Is that many lease models are designed that the primary benefactor is the financing company who's providing the lease. And so that was not at all our goal. As you've heard, we really wanted to focus 100% of that benefit or as much as we could on the consumer. And so it's been fantastic to see the positive response to that. We now have systems in, of course, Colorado. We have systems in New Mexico. We have systems going up in Minnesota. We have a system going up in Vermont. And so right now I think we're maybe 17 different facilities spanning 9 different utilities and 4 states and about 7 megawatts of capacity that's either up or currently under construction. As far as where that's going for the future, I mean, hopefully just more of the same, quite honestly, and I think that that's evident. We're now working with upwards of 100 utilities in different conversations across the country from East Coast to the West Coast and many places in between. And so I think, it won't be very long into the future when you'll see us in 2 and 3 times as many states with significantly more capacity and allowing that many more United States citizens to be part of the solution.
And where can people go to learn more about you?
Best place to go is easy, EASY. cleanenergy.com. cleanenergycollective.com will be easily the right place as well. And that's a good place to look at what we offer and how it works and how to get more information and how to maybe make these things happen in your neighborhood. We're certainly always looking for good partners, and as well as, our world turns because customers like what we're doing and buy these panels. And so we certainly owe a debt of gratitude to all of our customers as well as our utility partners who partner with us to offer the programs.
Paul, thanks so much for being with us today. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That was John Farrell, Wade Underwood, and Paul Spencer. Paul is the founder and president of the Clean Energy Collective in Carbondale, Colorado. For questions or comments, please email jfarrell@ilsr.org with Local Energy Rules Podcast in the subject. John's Twitter handle is John F. Farrell. This podcast was published on April 4th, 2013. Thanks for tuning in.